So the soul is the self that's animating the subtle body, and the subtle body literally generates the gross body, or at least according to the makeup of the subtle body. When the gross body is no longer habitable, the subtle body gives up the gross body and carries the soul into the next situation where, according to the configuration of the subtle body, a gross body is formed. And there's two terms in Bhagavad Gita. I'm sure one of them you're familiar with. Karma. Yes? No? No? Karma? Karma means two things. Activity and action and reaction. Like the law of physics. Action and reaction. So, it's a physical law. When I do something, that's karma. And within the laws of nature, a reaction for that action is set up. Just by my doing some action. Equal and opposite. Just like the laws of physics. So, if I do a good action, I do some act of kindness, according to the laws of nature, that kindness will come back to me. And the opposite is true. And life is a mix. So, this is a lesson from Bhagavad Gita. We're bound to reaction by our actions. It's a two-edged action-reaction. Both karma indicates both. Doing something, and the reaction received for our doing something. So the way that it works is, I'm doing something. There's sense impressions. I'm sitting here in the room in Washington University, and I'm hearing the sound of the fan, and I'm seeing the color of the wall, and you know, this nice table. And there are sense impressions that are coming in. That's the gross senses. And then those gross senses make an impression in the subtle body, starting with the mind. You know, the intelligence tries to analyze what that sense impression is and so forth. That's what the intelligence does. It's discriminating between, you know, is that sound a fan or is it something else? Is it an earthquake? It's just the building is trembling or something, I don't know. Is it this or is it that? Discriminating is the faculty of intelligence. And then false ego, which is the third component, is falsely identifying with it. Like, it's identifying, although my real identity is I'm the seat of consciousness, I'm the soul, identifying instead with the matter or the particular configurations of matter, which I'm perceiving through my senses, and it goes to the subtle body. That then so the mind gets an impression. Intelligence analyzes the impression or the experience, and the false ego identifies with it. That's me, or you know, it makes me happy, it makes me sad, I like it, I don't like it. Let me do something about it. So the intelligence is needed to do something about it. So there are functions of each of those components of the subtle body. So I'm going along with life like a camera, taking many impressions. And there's a really good filing system. It's invisible. It's better than any computer. There's so many megabytes, gigabytes, whatever you call the next level up, it just keeps going. There's this unlimited storage of impressions that are kept within the subtle body. And very important in all of this is time. Time energy keeps moving, tick, 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 tick. And the impression is stored, and at a certain point in time, the impression stored comes out, like as a desire. And sometimes it just stays stored for a very, very long time. And then, let's say, the body becomes useless. It gets discombobulated. It doesn't work anymore. So then it's time for the soul, the conscious self, to leave that body that doesn't work anymore. Death. So the subtle body continues while the gross body is left behind, and the subtle body with this super duper stored system of impressions of things that I did, things that I said, things that I experienced, it's carrying all of that. It's like a memory. And based upon two things, according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, karma, the activities that we have done, and that means the reactions that we're due to receive from those activities that we've done, and it's stored as impressions in the mind. And then the other is guna. Guna means quality. According to Bhagavad Gita, there are three principal gunas or qualities: goodness, passion, and ignorance, the force of maintenance, creation, and destruction. To have a universe, or to have activity, to have things happen within the universe, you need those three. It has to be created, it has to stay for some time, and it's destroyed after some time. And all the time, new things are being created, and all the time, some of those new things are being destroyed, or some of the other ones are being destroyed, and some things are being maintained. And those three modes of nature are operative as long as there's creation, as long as there's something manifest. So here comes the subtle body that has all these impressions that happened from the previous body, stored in this subtle body, and karma, previous activity and the reactions due, and the modes of nature, the qualities with which I have associated, determine those two things, determine the next body that I'm going to get. So by those two laws, that spirit soul covered by a gross body is transferred to the womb of the next mother, or whatever the process of the germination of life comes from. I can go into detail later, but there's different, according to the, now this is not Bhagavad Gita, it's another reference, it's Srimad Bhagavatam that says living entities are born from an embryo, like the womb of the next mother. Some are born as eggs from the womb of the next mother, a chicken or something. Some are born from fermentation, and some are born from perspiration. So they're living, that's the circumstances, like the, you know, the material energy is the mother, and the soul is like the seed, and the soul enters into the appropriate womb of the next mother, and then a life is generated. In which particular location, this one, that one, the other one, is dependent upon guna and karma. So what I'm doing today is going to determine tomorrow. And the combination of today's and tomorrow's is going to determine the situation in the next life. And when the subtle body, this is like a little detail about transmigration. The subtle body may not right away manifest those impressions. But as time passes, tick, 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 and the body grows, that is, desires are now being time-released by the force of time, because that's one of the agents of the Supreme. Time is one of his energies. Time opens up some of those desires, and things start to happen. I feel hungry, so I cry, and my mother gives me something, and it's so and so on and so on. It's just, one doesn't have to go to school to learn to cry, it just happens. Or one doesn't have to become hungry, it just happens, and so on. Things happen, and then by the time energy, that which is stored then comes out as a form of a desire. And the body is a machine or an instrument to help one fulfill type of desire? For example, very simple one that's given in the Veda. Supposing one it has the human form of life, and one has the tendency to just be literally indiscriminate about what I eat, rather than choosing things that are healthy, that produce longevity, what to speak of things that can serve to elevate my consciousness. If that's missing and it's just more or less like an animal, indiscriminately eating anything, everything, that's not what the human form of life is meant for. By design, it has another purpose. But if that's how I choose and live my life that way, then one may get in the next life a body more suited for eating indiscriminately. Anything, everything. Like a goat or a hog or just eating anything, everything. According to guna and karma. And so on. One may ravenously like blood, just speaking of food. And so eating meat, and the more raw the meat is, the better. And so there are bodies that are more suited for that than a human form of life, and one may get that form of life in their next life. And so on. So the species of life, that form of life that one receives, has to do with guna and karma. Supposing I do, I just live a reckless life and hurt all kinds of people and inflict great suffering and pain. So according to karma, I'll then receive a body that's going to receive a large amount of suffering and pain because I inflicted that suffering and pain on others. I make it a species that's a lower species. That's very, because I misused the freedom of the human form of life, my freedom gets restricted in the next form of life. Or it can go the other way. I can properly use my freedom and then I get more freedom. So that means I may receive birth in a higher heavenly realm. Or I may go down to the other place because I misused my human form of life and my free will. Like that. But there's a subtle body that's transferred to the place of birth of the next life. One of those is seeds. There's another source of generation. So anyway, the soul is carried to the next situation, and then life comes out where there's this, still the subtle body, the same one that was in the previous gross body, but there's a new gross body suited for the nature of the living entity. So, one of the messages, as Krishna describes, and the Vedas describe this process of transmigration of the soul, the advice that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita is, whether the position of birth is a very high one, or the position of birth is a very low one, or somewhere in between, in one sense they're all undesirable because it's still this cycle of birth and death. And the advice of Krishna is, don't stay in this Ferris wheel of it's not the real purpose of life. And the human form of life is an opportunity to end that cycle of birth and death. And the way for that to happen is the subtle body needs to get cleaned up. Subtle body needs to become purified. So there are different processes of purification. And one of those processes of purification we were reading about just this morning in the Bhagavatam class. And there are different. One of the processes is in the yoga system. So, do any of you here practice yoga? Asanas, right? Different seating postures you learn. Did you also learn pranayama, breathing exercise? Okay, so those are two parts of an eightfold yoga system. Have you learned that from your yoga class?
Okay.
The first two, basically it's do's and don'ts, like values that you should hold, that's yama. Niyama is things that you just don't do because they're hurtful to you and other living beings, and you shouldn't be hurtful to other living beings or to yourself. So do's and don'ts, like codes of conduct, principles that your life should rest upon. Then the asanas. Then the pranayama. That's the first four. Then there's eight more. Four more. The next one, after you become really proficient at those four, primarily asanas and pranayama, breathing exercise. Breathing exercise is meant to make the mind more peaceful, because the mind is a subtle form, but it's resting upon the life airs within the body. There's a science that says there's a certain number of life airs that are circulating in different ways, and if they're all in proper order, you have long life and a peaceful mind. So when your mind is more peaceful, nice. So people like pranayama, and it works. It's when you find someone that teaches you pranayama, you'll find it works. It's effective. But the continuing purpose is to connect, is to clean the subtle body. So pranayama is followed by number five, which is pratyahara. And pratyahara means to withdraw the active force of the senses, the subtle senses, and consolidate them. Something that's like a turtle or tortoise that withdraws his limbs. So there's this shell of the turtle, and then there's the limbs. And so there's a soft part of the turtle, but the soft part is protected within the shell of the turtle. Similarly, pratyahara is the active sense of looking for something to enjoy, smelling something to enjoy, touching something to enjoy, hearing something. The tendency to do that is withdrawn, and consciousness is then consolidated within. Where the mind is peaceful, consciousness is now concentrated within, and then there's this practice of meditation. And the last three, dhyan, dharana, samadhi. And the mind is then directed towards that which is not material. So this is, listen carefully, because it has, now it's getting in the direction of what's over here on the board or the screen. Supposing I'm involved, put it the other way, because I'm going to walk over this way. Supposing I'm involved in a process that says I'd like to become peaceful. I'd like to become perfectly peaceful, absolutely peaceful and calm. And out there's lots of disturbance. Pick your disturbance. Lots of it. So a goal that I would like is not to be disturbed by disturbing things, and so I'm going to consolidate my consciousness within. And so a yogi in the Eightfold Yoga System withdraws, extending the search for happiness outside, and looks for a search for happiness within, fixing consciousness upon this, the source of energy. The heart of this pranayama is following the breath, the incoming and outgoing breath, and meditating upon breath, because it's the breath of life. And then where the breath of life is being animated from, that's the soul within. And then finally the Supreme Soul, and fixing the mind upon the Supreme Soul, that the source of the soul, the breath of life, the subtle body, the gross body, and everything. consolidating consciousness upon the source of everything. Now, what's the source of everything? Interesting question. There are different ideas of what's the source of everything. Now, are either of you familiar with Buddhism? You two from China.
A little bit.
If you were asked the question, I'll ask you the question. What's the ultimate goal for, if one really, really goes all the way with being a sincere, serious, ardent follower of Buddhism, what's the goal?
Nirvana.
And what is Nirvana? Can you describe it, or have you heard it described?
Voidism.
Yes. Voidism. It's a condition of nothingness. You empty out all the things that life really isn't and dismiss them and dismiss things that life isn't, and what you're left with? You're left with Nirvana. It's a state of nothingness. This is an artist's rendering of the material world, the spiritual world, and that which is in between the spiritual and material world. Like I was describing, there's a soul within the body. I'm pointing to the heart because the Vedas consistently say the soul is in the region of the heart, not captured by the heart. If there's a heart transplant, the machine part moves, and the soul doesn't go out with the machine part. It's in the region of the heart. So the same soul stays if there's a heart transplant. It's there and animating the body. As long as it stays, it's animating the body. So, question. Where's the interface between where the soul is, that's fully spiritual, and where the body is, both subtle and gross? There's a fat which is in between, the buffer zone between spirit and matter. That's nirvana. That's, in the language, nirvana is a Sanskrit word. Vana in Sanskrit means forest. Or, and nir is negation. Not, it's out of, you're no longer in the woods of material life. Now where is that? It's not in the woods of material life. It's nirvana. It's nothingness. And that state of nothingness is the buffer zone between matter and spirit. It's something like where a river hits the riverbank. So there's the river, and there's the riverbank. And that which is neither the river nor the riverbank, it's that little line that's between the river and the riverbank. It's neither the river nor the riverbank. It's in between position. So the Vedic literature describes this as the river Viraja, or Karana ocean. It's this where matter meets spirit region. And those who are really like successful as Buddhists, they're program of becoming peaceful is to eliminate that which we are not, and we really have nothing to do with all these things that are temporary. So when you dismiss all of those things, what are you left with? Because there is not a positive conception of the seat of consciousness as there is within the Vedas. There's a very clear, explicit understanding of the seat of consciousness, that's the Atma, the soul. So the destination of such a person who's wishing to become peaceful through controlling their mind and senses by various disciplines according to the branch of Buddhism, they enter into this realm. So down within the causal ocean, there are these bubbles that are universes, And the universes are emanating from a form of the Lord called Vishnu, Mahavishnu. And from his body are streaming, as he's exhaling, unlimited numbers of universes that expand as he exhales, and when he inhales, they contract. And again, in a dissolved, neutral state, they enter within his body for a resting period, and then the universes come out, and then the universes contract. And it goes on eternally. So that's, according to the Vedic literature, that's Vishnu, who's lying within this causal ocean. And those who wish to become free from the distractions of this realm, this created realm, enter into that realm, the Karna ocean, or the river Viraja. Then the followers of the yoga system, this eightfold yoga system that I was describing earlier, they clearly recognize there's a seat of consciousness that's distinct from matter, and that's me. And I want to get in touch with me, that my real identity, the conscious self within, to the maximum degree that this human form of life provides or permits. And those who become so fixed enter into the spiritual sky. On the other side of the material realm, on the other side of the river Viraja, they enter into the spiritual sky, where everything is light, luminous, in spiritual light, not like night and day, sometimes light, sometimes not light. There's no matter. There's no influence of covering here, as there is here. So one may enter into this Brahmajyoti. And enter into the Brahmajyoti, there's a positive sense of I exist as a conscious being. But where that consciousness is directed is another opportunity is provided in the Vedas through this vastness of not just spiritual sky, but these are spiritual planets where there are spiritual beings with spiritual forms and spiritual activities and spiritual desires, all uncontaminated by matter. And the process of bhakti yoga, little distinct from Ashtanga Yoga, the Eightfold Yoga system, is directing the consciousness of the individual soul to the Supreme Soul, free from contact with matter, free from karma, material activity, free from the influence of guna, or the modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, an activity that's karma-free and completely separate from the influence of creation, maintenance, and destruction, or passion, ignorance, and goodness, completely free from those modes of nature, is existing in the spiritual sky, and spiritual planets exist in that spiritual sky. And therefore, because that's the goal, then one thing is there's no more birth here, and there's the positive sense of the soul's destination with the Supreme Soul in the spiritual realm. So, back to transmigration of the soul. One of the distinctions, because I've had this, I'm curious, so for those that are a little knowledgeable in Buddhism, it was at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I conducted a class some years ago on transmigration of the soul, and some Chinese girls came, graduate students, because they knew something about it and they wanted to hear what we were going to say about it. So we had some lively discussion afterwards. And I asked, you know about Buddhism? Yes. In Buddhism, is there a concept of reincarnation? Yes. The next question, what is it that's reincarnating? The answer was, we don't know. So I'll ask you the same question. According to the concept of Buddhism, what is it that's reincarnating? Buddhism? What is it that is reincarnating? I don't know. my understanding is Buddha didn't say, "Boo, there's no soul." He didn't say that. He just didn't speak about it. He spoke about reincarnation and the way to dissolve or break the cycle of reincarnation is to no longer participate actively in pursuing false happiness in a world that's false. Rather, contemplate with inwardly and act outwardly in a peaceful way. And by whatever the various disciplines are within types of Buddhism, come to this realization of the state of nirvana. So, reincarnation will continue as long as one is involved in pursuing happiness in things that are temporary. What's the alternative? One alternative is don't pursue it. Negation. Not positive, just don't do that. In the Vedic process, different than Buddhism, there's a philosophical approach that says, not this, not this. What is eternal? What is supreme? Well, it's not this, and it's not this, and it's not this, and it's not this. And when you're all done, you say, well, what is it? Well, it's not this, and it's not this. Neti neti, not iti, not this. So definition by negation takes one here. The positive existence of the soul frees one from the cycle of birth and death, and it takes one here into the light of the spiritual sky. Recognizing the soul and everything else, all souls and everything spiritual material, has its source of emanation, and that source of emanation is a supreme person, and just connect ourselves with that supreme person through acting consciously, even using our senses and our mind, the gross and subtle body, using them, the machine, in service to the supreme. Although presently these eyes can't see the supreme, and only to a limited degree can my intelligence discern what the supreme is beyond, you know, it's not this and it's not this. By spiritual sound vibration, one can hear the description, and gradually it becomes revealed through the purification of the subtle body. So, I understand you were... Say it again, that the theme that you've been speaking during the semester.
Enemies of the mind.
Enemies of the mind. So, just to connect this with your semester topic, there are ways of addressing the enemies of the mind by something we were discussing yesterday evening, by putting something on the other side of the pan scale, like Bhishma Dev, one teacher, was explaining to his students, the Pandavas, if there's anger, practice forgiveness. It relieves, it diminishes anger. Put something, whatever there is that's over here that's troubling the mind, put something else over here that's just the opposite, that's light instead of dark. And cultivate that, invest in that. And that it diminishes the influence. Just doing that, bringing your attention over here instead of over here, diminishes that. What to speak of, then it becomes more prominent, and light is stronger than darkness. Light will eclipse the darkness. So that's one of the processes of controlling the enemies of the mind. Another principle, besides the panscale principle, is bring the mind to that which is pure. Well, here's another one in between. Just fix your mind on one thing, like a discipline of a mandala. You know what a mandala is? Mandala is like a geometric pattern that is balanced and all the way, like yin yang, you know, something that's balanced all the way around. And you meditate on that, fix your attention on a mandala, and it helps bring the mind to a position of balance and tranquility and peace. Or just one thing, like, you know, a mark, a circle, or a candle flame. It's mechanical. Bring your consciousness to something, to one something. And I did some Zazen practice for some time, and that's just looking at a blank wall. You sit straight, lotus posture, blank wall, and let the thoughts go like clouds in the sky passing. And you don't initially, you know, everything, every attention goes to your thoughts that are passing through your mind, and it becomes like that, just cloud passing through the sky. And then you pay more attention to the sky than the cloud that's passing through the sky. Like this being, being conscious. And then being conscious of the source of consciousness, like self-awareness. It's very powerful. But where does all of that rest upon? And then when you stop that discipline, this was my experience, you stop that discipline and you get up and start, you know, doing what you'd normally do, and that focus dissipates. And the next thing, you're paying attention to the clouds in the sky or the thoughts in your mind, and you're moving. It becomes clear that life is just being moved by the thoughts in the mind. And, you know, that's based upon the desires in the heart. That's based upon my previous karma and my association with the modes of nature. So I put importance in blah, blah, blah. And someone else, they have a different experience and different modes of nature, and so their life is moving in a different direction. And so it's just this collage of many living entities doing many different things because of their contact with matter. So withdrawing contact from matter by some mechanical discipline is another dealing with the enemies of the mind. It's mechanical. But it's not sustainable. It's not natural. Ideal is then bring the mind in contact with that which is completely pure, and the mind then becomes purified. Like taking something that's taking a spark and bringing the spark closer to the fire. Or if you want to get warm and you're cold, stand near a fire, you get warm. By association with the fire, you get warm, because fire is warm. It's heat. But by associating with that which is pure, you become pure. The mind becomes pure, the heart becomes pure, consciousness gradually becomes pure, and then one can contemplate higher things besides, you know, the temporal things that otherwise are passing through the mind. So you let go of those things that are in the mind, but not just stay in a neutral state, but stay in a contemplation of what is our eternal position. Like when you're liberated, what do? And if one enters into the Brahmajyoti, there are statements found within the Vedas that says it doesn't last, because what a soul does by nature is we're active, and we're active in relation to the Supreme. So if that connection with the Supreme is not established, eventually one comes back down into this realm. Because when consciousness is not fully purified yet, the fully purified is the soul connected with and sheltered by and in a relationship with the Supreme Soul. That's like a description of what Bhakti Yoga does, and how it not only breaks the cycle of samsara, repeated birth and death, but it carries one to one's permanent position. This is not permanent, nor is this permanent. That's permanent, because of the natural, the real identity of the soul being part of the Supreme Soul. So that's what the solution to the how transmigration of the soul works. It's like a perpetual motion machine in real, like everyday life. It just keeps perpetuating. The energy, the energizer of it, is the soul looking away from the Supreme. Looking at matter and thinking, yummy, looks good, let me try it out. And it goes on endlessly. Turning one's, so relieving the enemies of the mind, put something that's more light in the side of, on the other side of darkness, or withdrawing oneself altogether from darkness by a mechanical means, or turning one's attention literally to the Supreme Pure. That's the solution to the cycle of birth and death. I used up my time. But there's, if depending on all of you, we can spend some time discussing some questions, either what I just described or some of the things that we've been going over during the semester. And I thank you for coming anyway, just because of you have exams and stuff going on. Yes?
Thank you so much. I'm very hungry right now.
You're hungry?
And I know food's good. But so my question is, like, how do you reconcile that? Like, I'm anticipating eating.
Fine. It's for sure.
Right, but say it wasn't, say it like I had to, like, just go down to the dump down there.
Okay. So,
like, do I purposefully choose food that's like doesn't taste good, or do I purposefully like not eat as much, or like
two things? Most important of the two things, or of the two, the most important one is what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, which is, accept as those things that you nourish your body with what's already been offered to Him, and as an offering of sacrifice and love to Him. That's the prasada message. He says, because otherwise, with every mouthful, one is becoming bound by the laws of karma. The act of eating itself binds one to the laws of nature. Whatever the item is, good tasting or not. So rather than being bound by the laws of karma, the laws of nature, first take foods that are the quality of goodness, you can learn what that is, offer them to the Supreme, and then you take, because you want to offer to Krishna something that's nice. But automatically it's going to be nice, because you want it to be nice before you offer it to Krishna. And if it's already like prepackaged, like an apple or a fruit or a flower or something that's just produced by nature, that's in the quality of goodness, that's fine. Or mix it with some other kinds of fruits or some other kind of vegetables or some other kind of meats or combination of motive goodness things. Prepare that, offer it to Krishna. Accept that. So that's first and foremost. And the other thing that you asked was, how much? So one is what, and then the other is how much. And the how much answer is not too little, not too much. You know what you require. And it's a good idea in yoga practice to strive for a little less. So better to err on the side of a little less than a little too much. So it's nice to just what you need. So you're not thinking after you finish eating or an hour and a half later. So eat what you require. But as your discipline of purification and yoga practice becomes more matured, you will require less. You will require less sleep, you will require less eating, you will require less involvement with matter in general. And that will then, that's because of something within. You're like spiritually energized within. And you're living off of spiritual energy rather than the other kind. And it happens naturally. You have to like twist your arm or do something, it didn't, it'll happen. But on the cultivation side, a little less. That's still your mind is peaceful and you can do your work. Yes.
Could we change that rule just for the lunch today? Because we've got a lot of prasadam.
Sure. We can serve it out right now.
No, change the rule of the little less part.
Oh, okay. Okay, fine. Because you're expecting more people to be in line, so.
Just, okay.
Okay, yes.
I have a question about disturbance.
About?
A disturbance.
Disturbance.
Yeah, so it's like people have attachment to the material world,
yes,
and they have disturbance from that, so it's not good.
Yes.
But like, if you have like some intimate relationship with either like your friends,
yes,
your loved ones, your family,
sure,
and you care about them,
yeah,
and
that's natural. All of that is natural.
But that will lead to disturbance,
yes,
according to what you said.
Yes. Therefore, what to do? Yes?
Yeah, that's my question.
Okay. Therefore, transfer, listen, I'll speak slowly, I'll say it twice, that very same attachment, transfer to who the person really is, meaning the soul. Okay, so like, I don't know you, but supposing we got to know each other, you know, a whole lot, and, you know, I started getting attached to you, and you started getting attached to me. Great. Now, what about the disturbance part? If I see you as spirit soul, and you see me as spirit soul, I still can relate to you, and, you know, according to the embodiment you have, you're these many years old, you have da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Whatever it is, you're a student and you're from China and, you know, whatever the other things are that make up your temporary situation. So your real identity is spirit soul. So I can relate to you day to day, moment to moment, according to the temporal situation, but my attachment should be transferred to you as a spirit soul. I'm respecting the temporary thing. And that's going to change, and over time it's going to change, and over time it's going to change. And then, you know, kaput, we're gone. Because the soul, the body gets worn out, and, you know, leave and go somewhere else and do something else. Even that can cause a disturbance, you know, the departure of a loved one, or the difficulties that they're enduring because they've got a body, and the body's, you know, things happen. It rips, or it breaks, or